Who is the Martian Emperor? When a giant airship descends on New York City in 1892 and threatens destruction if the world does not submit to the Martian flag, it's up to the mysterious Smith, inventor and adventurer, to find out what forces are at work. To stop the menace, they'll need to enlist the help of Theodore Roosevelt and other early 20th century heroes. It's the second book in Andrew Mayne's The Chronological Man series, and the Martian Emperor combines mystery, airship battles, and backroom Tammany Hall politics, all against the backdrop of a world on the verge of war. You can buy it for only $1 at Amazon or Nook, coming soon to Apple iBooks. It's Andrew Mayne's The Chronological Man, The Martian Emperor, available now on ebook. This is a free audiobook presentation of The Chronological Man, The Monster in the Mist by Andrew Mayne, read by Justin Robert Young. If you would like to download the full ebook for only 99 cents, head on over to Amazon or Barnes & Noble's Nook store or Apple's iBooks. If you are enjoying this presentation, head on over to the Amazon listing for The Chronological Man, The Monster in the Mist, and remember to leave a review. We appreciate it. Chapter 14. They said it was an oceanographic mission, like the kind that the university does, said the man named Broderick. The light from his green vial cast sinister shadows on his face. He shot a glance over his shoulder. Only this wasn't a scientific mission. When Mr. Reese stepped foot on the ship, we knew he was up to no good.
Mr. Reese? I don't believe I know him, said Smith.
Tall fellow, blonde hair. Looks like he might be Norwegian or Dutch. He works for the doctor in town. He was the one that chartered the expedition. We were to sail far north of the usual fishery and find a sperm whale. Not much call for them nowadays, but it wasn't for the whale. They wanted to use it to catch something else. 2 weeks in, we found a young sperm bull, maybe 40 feet. Took us 2 days to harpoon it, kill it, get it behind the boat. That's when Mr. Reese tells our captain to head dead north, close to the Arctic as we can, way out of the range of the sperms that time of year. Dragging that whale, we head full speed north. Sharks, some whites. When it was too cold for the bulls, come along to pick at it. We take turns in the crow's nest, shooting at them with a rifle. You'd see a fin poke out of the water, and a white get close to it as it saddled up to the sperm to have a nibble. Pop! We'd go at it with the rifle, shot one square in the eye, and watched it hang loose like a black grape. Thrashed its tail and swam off like an angry pirate. It was fun sport until it got real cold. Fewer whites came along to pick at it. The sperm was still mostly there. Its fins had been chewed when we couldn't snipe at it. We'd ask Mr. Reese what the bother was all about. Not much sport after a while in shooting at whites. He said that wasn't the point. He and his society, as he called it, were interested in what would come after the whites when we got real far north. He had us sail in a wide circle for a week, chumming the whole ocean with the body of a sperm. It seemed like nonsense to us, but it was easier work than actual whaling, if you didn't mind the cold. On the eighth night, going in circles, it comes. We see what Mr. Reese had sent us out for. It was below deck when I heard Jameson call out. I run up, and there's what he's looking at in the moonlight. It had two glowing eyes, like your little bottle there, only these are orange, orange like a flame. Its beak was nibbling on the sperm, taking big chunks. Mr. Reese comes to the deck and orders us to harpoon it with the powder gun. He said that's what we were after. A giant squid, said Smith. Broderick shook his head. No, that's the thing.
Some of us have seen those in our nets trying to take our catches in the middle of the night. This was different.
Different how?
Asked Smith.
Like man to a monkey. This monster sat out there, its tentacles pulling away pieces of the sperm, feeding it into its mouth. Those eyes, they watched us as we ran on deck. It knew what we were up to. Jameson ran over to the harpoon and swiveled it over to the thing. He leveled it at it and pulled back the bolt. We all looked at the beast, waiting to see the harpoon go through it, snaring it. We waited and nothing. We shouted at Jameson to fire. Nothing. I turned to look at him to yell at the bastard, and he's not there. We ran over to the railing. Nothing. No Jameson. Never to be seen again. Another man. Kennedy. He goes over to the harpoon. Only some of us keep an eye on him as he checks the bolt and brings it to bear on the thing. He's ready to fire when we hear a shout behind us. We turn around and there's no one there. Later on, we realized it was Saunders that time. We hear a splash. No more Kennedy. That's when we realize it. While we're watching, the beast out there feed on the sperm. Its mate is under our John Jackson. It's under our keel, feeding on us. Smith felt April's hand grab his arm through the leather armor.
Two of them, said Smith, hunting together.
Like a pair. Only these two aren't just hunting together. They're smart, real smart. They know what a harpoon gun does. That's why they'd take the man off. Whenever they got close. As soon as one would get near, a tentacle, thick as a man's body, would rise up out of the water and pull away whatever fool got close. The captain shouted at Rees to let us cut off the sperm and sail out. He'd have none of it. He told us to lash ourselves to the deck and finish what we were paid to do. He had a nasty temper. Yelled at us for taking the money when all we had to do was take pot shots at whites. Told us if we didn't get the beast, we weren't going to get paid. Then he got wise, took a smart approach. He offered $100 to the man who harpooned the one on the sperm. We all have a price. I tied a thick anchor rope and say I'd give it a shot. It was so cold I could barely tie the knot. Cold rain was splashing my eyes, but $100. It's $100. I get two of my mates, Carnegie and Matheson, to tie off the ropes to the mast, hold it to themselves. I walk over to the sloshy deck, grab one of the handles of the harpoon. Matheson lets go, goes to the bows, we can peer over and tell me when it's coming. I aim the harpoon at the beast out there in the sperm. Matheson lets out a scream. I don't bother to look, throw myself to the deck. Hear a whip go past my ear. Carnegie starts pulling the rope. I slide across the deck on my belly. I feel something strike my leg, and I let out a howl. Carnegie tries to pull me up, but I can't move. I look down, expecting to see the tentacle wrapped around my leg, but it's gone. Two other men help Carnegie pull. I scream as I feel the skin rip. That's when I notice I'm pinned to deck with this. Broderick pulled a large, curved amber claw from his pocket and held it up in the green light. It was nearly the size of his hand. Some men say you can tell the size of them things by the size of the claws they have. Maybe so. These things may not be the biggest creatures swimming in the ocean, but they're the meanest and the cleverest. But it was Mr. Rees who figured out how to get the one on the sperm. Cruel man. He talks us into lashing a volunteer to the harpoon. He goes below deck and gets old Webb. He's so soused half the time, he can't even piss straight, let alone fire a harpoon. Rees gets the man good and drunk, convinces him to go behind the harpoon. Webb thinks it's a joke, like a child he was. He's cackling that stupid laugh of his, mop of hair hanging down off his eyes. Toothless grin. Rees is just carrying on laughing with him, pouring brandy into him as the two fools tie the rope around his wrist, like executioners. They carry him over to the harpoon and tie his wrist to it. Webb looks over at us with his dumb face, laughs in his hoarse laugh. We smile at him, tell him he can do it. Too ashamed to tell him what his real job is. I was sitting mid-deck, holding my loose skin, tying a rag around the leg, but I knew I was no better. I was part of it. We all look over at Webb as he smiles at us. We see it behind him. Rees gives us a stern look, telling us to shut up.
Looks over at Webb, cheers him on. Poor fool had been below deck, didn't know what we'd already seen. Dumb when he was sober, stupid when he was drunk. He'd always been the butt of our jokes, always eager to please. He once tripped down a ladder. We laughed and laughed. His leg broke funny and almost died of infection. We kept him drunk. All he did was laugh when we got him soused. And cry himself at night, the pain. Got too much to bear. No family. We were all he had in the world. And this is how we treat him. Reese pushed the edge of his sleeve into the corner of his eye. I watched and saw. Webb swung the tip of the harpoon around, his hands bound to it. The thing came up behind him. Webb sees our face. He doesn't know what's going on, but he knows something's wrong. Stops his damn cackle. Tentacle lashes around his back. Webb let out a scream. He doesn't turn to look at the tentacle. He just looks at us, waiting for us to explain the joke, like he lay there, crumpled at the bottom of the ladder after we pushed him, leg twisted, white pain so strong he couldn't understand. He just looks at us like a dumb pup, trying to understand. Out there, strapped to the harpoon, the tentacle pulls him away, tries to take him away. He lets out another scream, still staring at us. Not at the thing, but at him. The tentacle pulls again, starts crying, not understanding, shoots out names asking for help. None of us do. Finally, turns his head, looks behind him. He sees the devil's tentacle arched from his back going into the sea. Probably sees the glowing eyes under the boat, lets out a shrill scream as the tentacle rips free, bits of skin and muscle stripped from his back. Tentacle slips out of sight. A man grabs a knife, heads over, cut him free. Reese strikes him down with his bare fist and yells at him to stand still. Webb keeps crying out. Blood is seeping out of his back as he hangs in the harpoon gun by his wrists. His knees on the deck like he's saying a prayer. Cries there for a minute. Felt like an hour. Then we see the tentacle snap back on the deck, grab him around the waist. Starts yanking him in the air like a dog on a bone. Creature's angry, frustrated, trying to get free of the harpoon before he fires. Only he doesn't realize it. Webb was never meant to fire it. The beast pulls and yanks. Your bones popping out of joints. The knots. Good seaman knots. They ain't gonna give. The harpoon gun itself starts pulling at its plating. It's dragged. 100-ton beast, and it's straining under the force. Webb is pulled sideways. His white face toward us. He lets out another scream, only it's silenced by his own sick coming out of his mouth. All that brandy we'd fed him comes pouring onto the deck, pooling with his blood, splashing toward us. Beast keeps pulling. Webb can't even scream anymore. There's no more air in his lungs. He just looks at us with his white eyes. Drowns in his own sick as the tentacle squeezes. It's when we hear the sound of the backup harpoon gun pop. That one we kept below on deck and used poor Webb to stall while we set it up. Harpoon shot right through the other beast as it kept carving up the sperm. It's Johnson who fired it, right through the creature's beak as it scooped in handfuls of flesh into its maw. Harpoon went through its gullet, probably whatever it had for a brain. The tentacles flailed around for a minute, then it went limp. I heard a snap, saw the other beast rip Webb apart. His guts and blood flew on the deck, tentacles shut beneath the waves, lower half of his body. The upper half hung from the harpoon gun, intestines unspooling under the deck. Thought he'd drowned his own sick. The time it had him in its vice, he'd been too drunk or stupid to know how to die. He looked away from the thing on the sperm, saw Webb looked at us from the body, then back at us. His face was white as the sperm, blood and the life draining out of him. He looked right at me and the others, and he grins. He lets out a cackle. He got the joke. The joke was on us. The nightmare had only just begun. Broderick looked at the back door of the saloon. It followed us. We lost 5 more men on the decks. Then we raced back here. Kept thinking it would turn around. It would leave us. After we pulled the beast on deck, cut loose the sperm, thought I'd go after that instead. We didn't know at first that it had been following us. We laid the beast we harpooned on the deck. Reese took it apart like a butcher. Eyes, beak, tentacles, all packed away in ice below. Wasn't the largest one we ever heard of, but it was the broadest, maybe the most heavy specimen any man could recall. Like I said, it was to other squid what man was to a monkey. Either a better version made by God or the devil. The way it thought was what unnerved us. 3 days after we cleaned the last of web off the deck, Malloy went missing in the night. An accident, we thought. Then Kendricks went missing. We figured. Johnson, the man who shot the mate, was too scared to go on the decks. Captain ordered him to. We got taken as well, but not before Reese. That bastard, he got his. He thought he was more clever than the beast, but he wasn't. He didn't realize what the difference is. He only got the one creature because he was willing to let a man die to do it. There's no genius in making another man die in your place. It's what animals do. Well, these creatures, they were smarter than the animals. Reese had called the captain and a few others down to the hull where he kept the parts. He wanted to show us something special. There was a foul mood on the ship that he wanted to understand. He reaches into a barrel of ice and pulls out something with his hands. Apparently tells us that no other man has seen this before. We were the first, and we should feel privileged. Captain just turned on his heels and walked away disgusted with the man and himself. The other men craned in to look, or I catch a glance. At first, I think it's one of them glowing eyes. Reach reaches in and pulls out several more, size of grapefruits. They look like giant, squishy marbles. Instead, something's floating. Stench is horrible. We lean in to get a closer look. Some of the other men run away, climb up the ladder. They see what's inside. Tiny, little, glowing, orange eyes. These are pups, or eggs, or whatever, floating around inside. Tiny versions of their parents. And they're still alive. Soon, Reese is all alone, admiring what cost 10 lives at that point. He looks at me and grins. I don't know what to say. All I can think about as I see one of them twitching his hands from the warmth is, I think I hear something. For sure, it's the ice settling. It reminds me I was just that same. Goddamn Webb's cackle. Reese went missing that night. We were too afraid to touch Chicago. We just headed back to the port, Galway's. To some like Carnegie, it's another story to tell at the bar. For me and the others, it's a nightmare. And I ain't gonna let go. Smith looked at the mass of the ships that poked out through the fog. Why are you still here? If it's there hunting you and anyone else it finds. Men been taken on dry land, fool. It's not the beast out there that's after us, it's Webb. He's what's out there in the fog. I'd sooner set foot in the deep ocean than middle of the street. Little difference. Smith shook his head. It's not Webb, I assure you. April squeezed his arm again. Smith looked over at her. It should have been obvious to us, especially me. What did all the locations have in common? April nodded to Broderick. It's okay, lass. I know you have a tongue, he replied. Oh, my. The sewers. At least one side on every street, said April. Good God, it's in the sewers, pulling people down in there. And that's where it'll have to be killed, unless we can drive it out, replied Smith. Chapter 15. Smith tried to talk Broderick into helping them, but the drunken sailor wanted none of it. April could tell the old sailor was afraid. But she sensed he wanted to do something. He just didn't know what. Can you at least help us find a harpoon gun? Asked Smith. Broderick looked at him cockeyed. Are you mad? What good will that do? Smith shook his head. It worked on the other one. It was a 100 million shot, straight through its beak, and that one was distracted. This one's a clever one, and ain't gonna fall for that trick twice. He kicked the planks beneath his feet. And down there, madness. Smith stood up and poked a finger at his chest. Then what would you suggest we do? You helped start all of this. Broderick jerked back and rattled a crate of empty beer bottles behind him. Don't be blaming me. My score was with Webb. Webb is dead. There is no ghost, just a creature. It's not possessed. It's not haunted. It's not the devil, said Smith. You want to know about the devil? Reprimanded Broderick. Smith reached out a gloved hand and pulled Broderick's face inches away from his own. "More than you'll ever know in your pathetic short life, Mr. Broderick." He pushed him away and turned to April. "Miss Malone?" April followed after Smith as he stormed out of the alley. She glanced back at Broderick. The man shrugged. Broderick watched them retreat into the fog. He reached down to scratch the itching wound on his leg and then shouted out, "There's a harpoon gun on the John Jackson! Help yourself! There's no one left there to stop you!" Smith walked down the gangplank to the stern of the John Jackson. April waited nervously at the top. She scanned the black water. Every wave and ripple looked like a tentacle rolling across the surface. Smith shouted back at her, "If you smell ammonium, then you'll know it's near."
"Are you sure?"
She smelled lots of things on the breeze.
"No, I told you to wait in the harbor master's office anyway."
April shook her head and wrapped her hands around a wooden piling. She watched as Smith went below deck. She could see the deck-mounted harpoon gun on a riser near the broad, flat stern. There was a small piece of cord still tied around one of the handles. It was hard to see through the mist, but the rope had an almost black sheen to it, like dried blood. That was where Webb died, she thought. The planks of the deck had gouges and stains where the whales had been slit open and desecrated. The whole vessel had a dark color from the boilers that rendered the whale fat. They sat silent now. The smokestacks looked like black pillars in her mind. She tried to imagine what this vessel must have looked like to a sea creature as it plowed its way through the waves, rumbling with its boilers and sending up trails of black smoke that ran for miles. The shouting men, the bells, the sharp harpoons must have looked like a fearsome creature itself. A wave splashed against the side of the boat, and it rocked, gently, startling her for a moment. What kind of animal would go against this beast of a machine? She'd heard the stories of angry whales taking them on and sending them into the sea. To her mind, that was more like an angry bull smashing something apart along its way. But a creature that would follow and hunt the man on this vessel for hundreds of miles? She turned to look at the pale yellow lights of South Boston behind her. To find its way here, under the city itself! April's supernatural inclinations didn't extend very far beyond the church steps. She had rational fears of the unknown, and she waited for the mysterious Smith to return. She wasn't sure what rational or irrational was anymore. If a man could live as long as he has and look as he does, along with all of his other secrets, maybe the devil could send a creature to do its bidding, to seek out revenge, to terrorize those around it. Another wave splashed at the side of the John Jackson. April smelled the air. The only scent that stood out was the smell of salt and dead fish. She let go of the plying and tucked a lock of hair back under her cap. The disguise didn't have much of a purpose now, but she was always mindful of her appearance, even when she was dressed like a boy in a second-hand pair of trousers and a peacoat. "What are you doing out here, Miss Malone?" she said to herself, while listening to Smith's sounds below deck. She knew the answer. She was too smart, too curious for a woman in her time. She fantasized about going to Paris, or perhaps being a missionary in some far-off land. Neither one had much interest in themselves. It was just an idea of adventure that intrigued her. She placed the umbrella under her arm and shoved a hand into her pocket and felt a coin. She pulled it out and stared at it. Napoleon's face stared back at her. So many questions. The boat rocked again and pulled at the ropes tethered to the pier. April noticed something splashed in the water. She was certain it was a fish, but her mind kept playing tricks on her. She tried to take a nose full of air, but the cold wind was making her sinuses shut. She gazed down the pier to the harbor master's office. There was a dull light from the gas lamp in the window. It was 300 yards away. So far away. There was another splash. April looked at the waterline on the boat. The vessel was so dark, it was hard to tell where it ended and the sea began. She heard a loud sound and had to stifle a scream. At the stern of the boat, Smith had just dropped a harpoon gun as he climbed up the ladder from below deck. "Are you okay, Miss Malone?" he said, as he heaved the heavy gun over her shoulder. "Yes, fine. Just admiring the night air," she replied. She shot a glance back at the waterline. Nothing stirred. Smith walked up the gangway with the gun on his shoulder. With the pointed shaft in the barrel, it was as tall as he was. To April, it looked like a rifle made for a giant. "Nice gun," she said. Smith reached the pier and set the butt end of it down. He looked it over. "I guess so. Not much corrosion. I hope the charge fires." He looked at April. "Looks like I get one shot." He reached the hand up to touch the sharp tip of the harpoon. "What happens if you miss?" Smith bit his lip. "That would be bad." He reached down to pick up the gun. April grasped the barrel and held it in place. Smith looked up at her, confused. "What happens if you miss?" she repeated, worried. Smith shook his head. "I run. I swim." He tapped the metal plate of his armor with his chest. It made a clang. "I've got this on, too. Don't forget." April let go of the gun. Smith threw it over her shoulder. "What do these things normally eat?" asked April. "Whales, sharks, other squid, I suppose," said Smith as they walked back down the pier. "Are they like an octopus?" "Superficially, maybe. We don't know much about them, let alone this one," replied Smith. "I trust your memory is better than mine." "Could they eat things like an octopus would? Lobsters, clams, shellfish?" Smith thought for a moment. "Sure, its tentacles are probably strong enough to pry them apart." April tapped the metal armor on his back. "Big shellfish, Smith." Smith stopped and turned. "Miss Malone, what are we supposed to do?" "Not get killed, for a start. As you are aware, I'm very keen, you could say an expert, on not getting killed. We can't go to the police or anyone else until we have some sort of proof of what's going on. Right now, you and I are fugitives because Dr. Lindstrom has convinced them that I'm some kind of killer maniac. We don't have any options." April shook her head. "More than you want to see right now, the lawyer that hired me, Mr. Cohen, he could get a warrant straightened out tonight if you wanted." "Barring them finding any bodies in my basement," said Smith. "Are there any bodies in your basement?" April took a step back. "None that aren't supposed to be there," he snapped. April decided not to push that issue any further. "Mr. Cohen is an excellent attorney, and I don't think filing a lawsuit against the Kraken is going to help. I doubt he'll show in court," continued Smith. "That is the real problem. My brother knows people over at MIT. We could get an expert tonight, someone who could verify what we know," said April. "Verify what? That a drunk sea dog's guilt-ridden story? We have nothing other than stories and innuendos." "You're impossible, Mr. Smith," shouted April. "Smith! Just Smith! Whatever. Use your elliptical problem-solving to come up with a better solution than your one-shot harpoon," said April. She admired the man's bravery, but was frustrated by his stubbornness. Smith shrugged. "You are the computer." "Fine," April thought for a moment. "If it's living down there, that means it's feeding down there, too. It has to take the people somewhere unless it's dumping the bodies out at sea." April looked out over the fog-covered harbor. "But the bodies will be washing up on shore, and they haven't. So that means it's leaving the bodies in the sewers, either sporadically or in a nest." She remembered something. "They're pelagic creatures, most likely. Not living on the floor, so that means they're likely to nest. So that means it probably leaves its prey near its hunting ground after it feeds." "The bodies could be anywhere," said Smith. April turned off to the side as she recalled the map of the missing persons in her mind. "Accepting the distribution on the map, there should be a body within 4 to 5 block area of each vanishing point, far enough away that if anyone poked their heads in the sewers to look, they probably wouldn't have seen anything. Close enough that you shouldn't have to spend too much time down there to find one." "So now you're sending me down there?" asked Smith. "If we can get a body," April shuddered and put the thought out of her mind, "whatever is left after the squid is done, then I'd imagine a marine biologist could tell the difference between what a squid would do and what a man would do.
Fine, but I'm still bringing the harpoon gun, said Smith.
But you're only going down there to get a body.
Sure, agreed Smith.
Meanwhile, I'm going to contact Mr. Cohen and find someone at MIT to meet us at the police station. That's if you won't reconsider your stupid expedition.
You can use the telephone in the office. Cohen has one at his home as well. He and his firm are paid well enough to be bothered at this hour.
There's been a telephone in there all this time? Asked April.
Smith looked down at his watches.
Yes, but there are still too few people around to talk on the device. They're not much use.
Maybe in 100 years, said April.
Chapter 16. Smith and April rode the motorcycle through the fog to a small warehouse 2 blocks away from the office.
What are we doing here?
Asked April, eyeing the decrepit-looking buildings.
I don't think it's safe for us to go through the front door. I'm sure Lindstrom has more police waiting, maybe even the 4 police officers I ran into.
He opened the door and wheeled the contraption inside. April followed him, closing the door behind them.
There's a tunnel here that leads to the basement of the office.
Smith struck a match and lit a lantern. April looked around the interior of the warehouse. The floor was littered with large crates filled with machine parts. Smith walked over to a small wooden closet and opened the door. He reached inside and pulled a lever. The back wall of the cabinet slid backward, revealing a set of stairs.
"This way, Miss Malone!"
He guided her down the steps, holding the lantern aloft.
"Don't worry. I'm fairly certain my tunnels are free of sea creatures."
"Tunnels?" April hesitantly stepped down the stairs and walked into a narrow corridor. The walls were lined with large rocks. It had an almost natural look to them, almost as if they'd always been there.
"Ahead, about 100 yards, said Smith.
April let Smith take the lead. They passed several junctions that led off into dark places. She counted at least a half dozen metal doors that looked like weather-beaten versions of the one in the office. Pipes, conduits ran through the corridor, suggesting that the entire block was actually one structure. Behind some of the doors, the low rumble of machinery could be heard. She reached out to touch one of the doors. It felt cold.
"What's behind these doors?" she asked.
"Other buildings, other offices,
other Miss Malones."
Smith let out a laugh.
"Just kidding. There's only one April Malone, bless her brave spirit."
He paused and regarded the doors.
"Part of the machinery. A giant clock."
"What kind of clock?" she asked. Her fingers touched rivets in one of the larger doors.
"A clock that tells when it's time for just men to take action."
"Like now?" she asked, not quite understanding what he meant.
"The shape of things is always hard to know, Miss Malone. My elliptical geometry can only tell us small parts, but what we're doing will play some difference. Set things right for now."
She reached a metal door, and Smith pulled out another key. He unlocked the door and held it open for April. He looked at the flight of stairs leading up and then back at him.
"This will take you up to the office. I have to get a few things. Don't worry. I'll be up in only a few minutes."
"I could help," said April, as she looked down another dark corridor.
"I know. Lots of mysteries. The truth is much more boring. In time, maybe I can show you some of the more interesting things."
"Sorry, I don't mean to pry," said April.
"Don't ever apologize for your curiosity, Miss Malone.
Never.
I'll be up in a minute. You'll find the telephone in the drawer to the left of my desk. I believe you already know where the directory can be found."
April nodded and walked up the steps.
Ahead of her, a large metal door began to open. When she stepped through it, she realized this was not the same door she'd stepped through that morning. This was the storage room. Curious, she thought.
April called Mr. Cohen first. It didn't take her too long to explain the situation. He seemed to be expecting something like that. He made a comment about rousting a senile judge and said that he'd be at the police station in an hour. She next called the operator at MIT and spent 20 minutes trying to get her to find someone in the marine biology department who was still awake and could take her call. Smith entered from behind the door, holding a large duffel bag. He overheard her talking to the operator. He placed a hand over the mouthpiece of the phone.
"Tell her you're Mrs. Eddington's assistant and that you're calling on his behalf."
April looked at him, confused.
"He's a very big donor," whispered Smith.
April nodded, then spoke into the telephone. 10 minutes later, she managed to reach someone in the aquarium and explain the matter to him. She hung up and looked over at Smith. She'd been too busy talking on the phone to notice what he was up to.
"Oh, my,"
she exclaimed, noticing some kind of weapon strapped to the armor.
"What is that on your chest?"
Smith looked down and smiled at his creation. "It's basically a modified Gatling gun with much shorter barrels." He reached up and gave it a spin. The 10 pistol-sized barrels, arranged in the circle the size of a tea saucer, spun without a click. "It seemed like a clever idea at the time, when I mounted it to the armor." Smith looked up.
"It hurts a lot."
"I bet it does. I can't imagine what it'd be like to be on the receiving end of that," said April.
"Actually, I meant... never mind. I think you're right, in that I shouldn't go down there with just that."
He motioned to the harpoon gun leaning against the door. "To be on the safe side, I was thinking we could flush it to one end of the sewer." Smith walked over to a drawer, pulled out a rolled-out map. He unfurled it on his desk. "You can see the new sewer works and the older ones on this." April traced a finger along the line that ran down South Boston. "I need to know where to put my tunnels and where not to," said Smith. He picked up a pencil and set it on the middle of the map. "Could you mark out all the places that people went missing?" April drew an X over the location for every missing person that they had an address for. All of them were over major sewer lines. Smith traced the line with his finger along the middle of the map. "I want to create a distraction to drive it away from here, long enough for me to find some kind of evidence. A body, or..." His voice trailed off.
"A signed confession?" April smiled.
"He could use his own ink, at least," said Smith.
"Or is that octopus instead of ink?"
"Octopi," Smith. "And squid have ink as well," she looked up. "And nasty parrot beaks and razor tongues they use to devour adventurers." She reached out and gave the Gatling gun a spin.
"Please be careful. I'd hate to lose my employer the same day I meet him."
"I will be," he said, trying not to make eye contact with her electric blue eyes.
"It would look dreadful on my resume."
She saw where he'd draw the line.
"So how do you plan on creating the distraction?"
"With those," said Smith, as he pointed to a dozen bottles poking out of an open duffel bag. "They're incendiary devices with a fuse of my own design."
"Of course."
The man was endlessly clever, she thought. Perhaps too clever.
"I plan to drop them along here."
He pointed to the sewer line that ran north and south. "I'll place them into the drains here and through here. They'll all go off at the same time, give or take 2 seconds. That should create a wall of fire."
"Trapping the creature?" asked April.
"Not so much trapping as giving him a reason to stay clear of the area while I look for our signed confession." Smith drew a map for her on how to leave the office and to make it to the warehouse exit. "I'll leave the door open here. If you run down the corridor in either direction, you'll find an exit, all of them open from the inside." Smith walked toward the door they'd entered through. April followed him to the doorway. They stood there for a moment of silence. Smith stared at his boots.
"Miss Malone, if something should happen, Mr. Cohen will..."
April put a finger to his lips and shook her head.
"You're an odd man, Smith.
A little brave and stupid, but most definitely odd." She leaned in and gave him a kiss on the cheek.
"For luck."
"For luck," said Smith, as his face broke out in a blush. He grabbed the harpoon gun and duffel bag and walked down the stairs. April watched him step into the darkness. She thought she heard him stumble as he reached the bottom.
"I'm okay,"
he shouted. He reminded her of her brothers and their friends when they all got bundled up to go on one of their hiking expeditions. Only Smith was going to be facing creatures worse than bears or an angry moose. From his confidence, she assumed this was the kind of thing he was used to doing.
This is a free audiobook presentation of The Chronological Man, The Monster in the Mist, by Andrew Main. Read by Justin Robert Young. If you would like to download the full ebook for only 99 cents, head on over to Amazon or Barnes & Noble's Nook Store or Apple's iBooks. If you are enjoying this presentation, head on over to the Amazon listing for The Chronological Man, The Monster in the Mist, and remember to leave a review. We appreciate it.